With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We doing
Jefferson? Hell yeah.
Is my video not on? Here we go.
Not yet, but
all right,
there it is. How are you, dude?
I'm okay today.
Awesome. Thanks for rescheduling with me, man.
My pleasure.
We were just about to get in some really good stuff, but there's all the chaos of the street kind of distracting, and I like to try and just sit down and connect when doing these things. And I didn't want to piss away a good conversation, basically.
All right. Well, you know, we could have just had it twice. We would have had a warm up.
Well, to be honest, I felt like I got a pretty good sense of some of the things that you've experienced and been through and been a part of. So at the risk of, you know, retracing some of those initial minutes of that conversation, you are a lifelong born and bred Seattle native, correct?
Well, I'm born in Tacoma, but most people don't know what that is, so they're just kind of the same.
It's
45 minutes south of Seattle.
Right.
But yeah.
So is that where you went to school?
Yeah, when I went.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that leads me nicely onto this
question.
I
went to school down there when I actually moved out, and I moved out at 14 years old. And by the time I was 16, I lived in Seattle and we had an apartment. And I found out that I could get, they said, you know, if you're still in high school, you can get your Social Security payment, because my stepdad had died when I was like 13 or 14. And so I had Social Security benefits coming from him, but I didn't know. So when I turned 18, they said, if you're still in school, you can continue to get benefits. But my mom was getting all the benefits and I wasn't seeing any of it. And so I was just kind of living on the streets and at practice rooms and stuff. So they told me they would, if I stayed in school, I'd get these benefits. So basically I kind of got paid to go to school and finish my high school, you know?
So you kind of beat the system in a way.
Well, or the system did what it's supposed to do. And at that particular moment, and, you know, supported me so that I could continue to go to school rather than having to live on the streets, you know? So I guess that was good.
Did you have brothers and sisters growing up? Was it just you? Were you the only child?
Yeah, I got an older brother. I'm an only child too, though, because he's adopted.
Right.
So they adopted him because they didn't think they could have kids. And then I surprised him.
And where was your dad?
Huh?
What happened to your
dad?
My
real dad?
Yeah.
He lives in Spokane, Eastern Washington. He's kind of an ex-military dude. And he had a rough childhood himself. So he likes to live out there in the sticks, kind of isolated. You know, he prefers animals to people. And, you know, but once in a while I'd get in trouble fighting with my brother and they'd send me over there to live with my dad. And so that's where I learned how to drive and, you know, build fences. And, you know, I've castrated some cows and stuff when I was a kid and drove a lot of combines and all that. And I actually think I might've learned to sing out there too, because I'd listen to my Walkman or whatever. And then while I was driving the tractor in the middle of nowhere, you could just belt it out without worrying about anybody hearing you, you know?
So proper man stuff, apart from maybe the singing.
Yeah. Well, and then I've been a contractor. At around 22, I started a framing contractor business. So I've been doing that all my life, you know, just building things and making things. And that's how I supported my music habit and paid for all my early demos and all that stuff, you know.
What was the first band that you got into that made you want to, you know, start writing and pursue music as a full-time kind of, if not career, at least passion project?
Yeah. Well, the Seattle bands that I saw, you know, at 14 or whatever, before they made it, definitely made me realize it was tangible. But I was one of these kids that was always writing songs. Even before I went to school, I would like take a song, a melody off the radio, and I would create my own lyrics and stuff for it, you know, and like change it to, you know, if I was into like Star Wars or Army or something at that point, I might take a hit off the radio and then change it to be around, you know, about Chewbacca or something like that instead of the whatever it was about. So I was always just kind of a creative kid, you know, like other kids wanted to play with their toys or whatever. I always wanted to build them little tents and little, you know, like my G.I. Joes, I wanted to make them a tent, and I would, you know, I wouldn't, you know, it's little landscapes. I was constantly like making things. I kind of enjoyed making things more than the actual playing part, you know?
Do you then look at music and creativity as building? You're just building with the brain, or do you look at craftsmanship and creativity as two separate things, disciplines?
There's a lot of parallels and there's a lot of the same benefits, you know, until I was on a tour bus with stuck on a tour bus for 6 weeks with 9 guys every day, all day long. I never thought that I was like a loner. I always thought like I loved people and loved to be around people, but all my life I've always worked so much alone. I spent a lot of my life alone. And so I think that, you know, in construction, you know, you definitely, you're intimidated if you see a foundation and you know you have to build this house on it. You know, it's kind of intimidating, but you know, it's just one step at a time. And writing songs are similar in the same way, you know. And a lot of times if you're playing with a band, it's similar to like being in a crew, you know, and you do the best you can and find out who's should be handling what areas. And so in that way it's creative. But also I do a lot of listening to, you know, writing songs, a lot of it is listening, not just to other people's music, but your own creation. So sometimes I'd be on a job site building something and that would keep my body occupied. Mm-hmm. And I was able to like reflect on the songs that I was working on so that once I got off work, I could go and try out ideas and that sort of thing. You know,
were you a happy kid, Jeff?
No, I don't think so.
No,
I don't think I was a happy kid. I think I figured myself out recently. And what I think is I'm a, optimist that focuses on the negative because the positives are already taking care of themselves, you know? So I'm always looking for what I can do to improve the situation, but I had a pretty tough upbringing with my parents split when I was 3. And then my mom had married an ex-con and it all went to hell in a handbasket pretty quick. So when I moved out, it was when I was 14, it wasn't like I was kicked out or it was just easier to live on my own than it was to live through the drama and the hardships that were there at home. So, you know, I think a lot of that made me kind of unhappy. And I think music was always the thing that kind of kept me stable, you know, and the same thing too with music. Like I've went on some benders and had some challenges with drugs and alcohol, but always having music to focus on was always like the key thing that like kept me semi straight, you know?
Did you make good friends in the music community?
Oh yeah. My whole entire life is all built around those people. You know, those are all my longest relationships. Still, even half the guys that, you know, even guys that I did construction for, or people that I build houses for even now, or my company does, because mostly I just kind of, at this point, I'm kind of like a CEO or something. And then my company runs itself, you know, but I kind of check in on things. But even then, a lot of the people that we work for are all based off of music contacts. And, you know, for like right now, I'm just about to remodel a bathroom for a famous Seattleite, you know, which I'll protect their identity. But, you know, So we're always doing something like that. And it's all kind of built around this community, or we have like the people that did the books for Alice in Chains and Mark Lanegan. Like we did a remodel for them. And then also me and Ben are partners on remodeling old theater in Des Moines. So we will own it when it's done, and we're building a venue there. And that's all kind of built around music relationships and stuff too. I met my wife from playing music. I met the mother of my kids from playing music. It's all just, it's kind of my life, that and building stuff, you know.
It's nice that, you know, something can happen on such a mass scale and blow up. So it's worldwide talking about the Seattle music scene. And I guess a lot of heartache and pain and tragedy and bullshit came along with the success that that scene enjoyed. But it's nice that all the key players that were probably there before the media and the rest of the world started invading it have stayed the course and maintain their relationships and continue to hang out long after that frenzy and party died out. Is that the case?
Yeah, we're pretty tight with a few of those people. And, you know, like one time I was in playing a show in Los Angeles, and it was a good show. It was a small show. And my wife, I was flying to those shows because I didn't want to be stuck into the van with it, with the people I was doing the tour with. And, so we were flying in the show, and so I brought my wife with me, and we were playing Los Angeles, and she kind of got emotional because she's kind of has a really big music vocabulary and huge library. And she saw all the, you know, Black Flag when she was 12, and, you know, her first concert was David Bowie, and she probably knows more about current music than I do. You know, she has a thick record collection and a vast knowledge of music. And she told me, she was like, I don't get it. There's so many horrible bands out there. And why don't you have your, you know, where is your big break or something? And I actually have seen, you know, witnessed some of the hardship that these people have dealt with. And I kind of feel like it was a blessing to not have a, you know, a big break. I'm still as passionate about music as I have ever been and making records. I haven't lost a taste, or I don't feel like it's a job, you know, which some people do. And I, had I experienced all that stuff at a young age, I would probably be a monumental asshole at this point due to what it can do to people's egos and their sense of reality, you know. And I'm just not sure with the, you know, some of the anger I had as a kid that I would have been able to navigate that in a healthy way. And so I could have been a casualty. So at this point, you know, I've had a slow trajectory of things happen for me through music, and it's been really great. And, you know, I think that I might be just hitting my prime now versus some of these people that hit their prime at 26 years old, and everything after that was just, you know, cash in the check, you know, which, yeah. So I, you know, and a lot of people that I admire had a similar trajectory too, that took a long time, you know, whether it's, you know, Tom Waits didn't have a gold album until he was 50, or, I mean, you could see what's going on with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, but at 30 years old, he was still playing the Roxy. You know, and now at 65, he's probably at the peak of his career, you know, and I kind of still have hope that, you know, things are just going to continue to grow. And I don't need to ever be that big, but it's nice to just, if you planted some seeds, to see those seeds grow into something, you know, it's exciting, whether it's building a house or your garden or your family or whatever. It's nice if you put that effort in love into something, you want to see it evolve. But I don't want to be in a dangerous situation that actually starts to cause harm and makes me lose, you know, you can, if your passion turns into a product, you could lose your passion pretty quick. And that, I would hate that.
Do you have 100% pride for everything you've done? Because listening to your back catalog of albums, they all stand up. And they're all great records. There isn't like that dud in the mix. For me, as a, you know, a casual listener, I've gone through and listened to all the stuff you've made over the last 15 years that's available. And it's all just great, rich, you know, timeless music, I find.
Well, you can just, anything more you want to add to it? Because I can listen to that all day. There's one record.
Yeah. And, is that the one that's not available on Spotify?
It's not available. And I have a case of all the existing CDs, and I will never let them out.
Is that Sexual Uno? Is that record?
No, that one. That one's just not in print. But right. I think there's some good stuff on there, too.
It's before that, is it? It's before that album.
Yeah, it was before that. I had a band, and I think half of the record is good. But then there was some band politics that some other guys ganged up on me and maybe put some songs on there that I didn't believe in, you know? Right. And at this point, ever since then, you know, when you make a record, it has seven songs you love and four that you hate, that you're so embarrassed of those other four that you don't want anyone to hear the other seven. I decided at that point, I'm going to maintain full on veto power. I'll never put out a song that I don't believe in, at least at that time, you know? And even now, some of the stuff that was early that I felt was a, you know, I think I've improved as a songwriter in some ways, but there's something about where those songs were written that I know where I was at. And I kind of like the evolution of some of those early songs were simple and the, you know, it got a little more intricate as we got older. So I'm really proud of it. And I think that's my, you know, that's what I measure a great band by. There are some great records, you know, the first Guns N' Roses record, Sex Pistols, Nevermind the Bollocks. But like when you get these bands like the Stones or even the Cult, for instance, like Love Electric and Sonic Temple, that's a pretty freaking good run. If you got a band that has a 3-record run or a 4-record run of just albums that are not a stinker on any of them, that's like, I've always wanted that, to achieve that kind of thing and like put that kind of love into every record, you know?
Who were you playing with when you first started out then? You mentioned going about town and seeing the bands who were around then. I guess we're talking mid to late 80s. Is that when it began for you or a little bit before?
Well, right around 89 is when I started playing live, 90, you know, and I probably played my, you know, like I saw Alice in Chains probably playing 88. So I was like, you know, I think I was still 14 when I saw him play. And then when I seen him play, it was a life changer for me, you know. I mean, I just think, you know, Layne Staley is just one of the best singers of all time, you know, and they have such great songs and every member is just such a monster at what they did. And then, which the world all recognized with those first couple records, for sure changed a lot of, it changed music. I don't even think people today, there's so many bands that have imitated Alice in Chains with their harmonies and stuff that I don't think that people could recognize what, unless you live there, how fresh and exciting that sounded when it first came out. Now it's almost like a staple of active rock radio that people with those harmonies and that kind of riff, you know? And so they were a huge influence. So when I saw them play, I immediately went and started writing songs. And then we found, me and this bass player guy found a little drummer, but we had his older brother, who's still a really good friend of mine, sing for the band. But he was like, never wanted to be a singer, couldn't really sing. But he was just like, thanks guys for my, I got to have that experience, you know. But right out of the gates, I think because I looked like I was older because I was kind of a tall, lanky kid, and I had spent years in my house shredding on guitar. And so some manager guy that I'm still friends with today, you know, called me on the phone and he was like, hey, you want to join this other band, who I had seen, and they were already playing with Alice in Chains and stuff. So I joined them, and so I think I was 15 and they were all like 24, and I started playing, you know, with these other bands. And it's like, you know, I moved out of my house and I moved into their band house, and you know, I could already hang with drinking and, you know, not being goofy with drugs and stuff like that, because I grew up pretty rough. So I kind of could hang with adults like that, knew when, if I had to puke, we better step outside and don't let anybody see it, you know, or if you're having too much, maybe just disappear and find a place to sleep. So I didn't really embarrass myself that much, but I was pretty street smart. And so I lived with all those older guys and my nickname became Junior. And I just started going around town writing songs, but we had labels, we did tours, we did, you know, we had, you know, demo deals and all this kind of stuff, but no one liked the singer. So, you know, even like the first record deal I was supposed to get, I wasn't even old enough to sign the record deal yet, you know? And so, but everybody, that label ended up going under. It was actually, what were they called? I don't know. They were part of Elektra and, I don't remember Chameleon was the name of their label. So they put out like, Dramarama and, My Sister's Machine and stuff, which was another Seattle's band. So I got to, you know, I showed the ropes pretty quick, but I never had a singer. So I just hung around town playing with these bands and playing guitar, but I just could never find my Mick Jagger or my Robert Plant or whatever. And so it's just like, eventually a singer didn't show up to a session and the bass player I wrote the songs sometimes, the lyrics and stuff. So he says, we were doing a demo. We won like a battle of the bands and got some free studio time. And he was too busy being Jim Morrison or something, decided it would be rebellious to just leave us hanging and not show up. So we recorded without him. And that was the first time I ever sang. And the band just kind of decided right now that at that point, they were like, you know, fuck that guy. He just doesn't, you know, we're not going to play that shit. And so we booted him and I started singing at that point. And it took me a minute to figure it out, you know, like who I wanted to be as a singer and to be comfortable fronting a band, you know. So first you go through some imitating other people and this and that till you kind of figure out how you were. So I wasn't the type of guy that was like dancing around the house with a microphone trying to make everybody check me out. You know what I mean? I was very more like introverted, hiding in my room, writing songs kind of guy. But then it was kind of had to decide at that point, it was either have a music career or wait around forever and be at the mercy of waiting for this singer guy to show up or, you know, figuring out how to do that on my own. So that's what kind of gave me a late start. So I never probably started singing until I was 22 or 23. And then when that started happening, things started, doors started opening pretty quick. So I guess I'm glad I did.
And you, I guess, watched, you know, the media descend on your town and every band get signed up. You saw that invasion happen firsthand, right?
Yeah. And I just think I was too young. And like I said, wasn't with the right people. You know, so many people think it's not just one person thing. You know what I mean? You could be so driven and so good at what you do, but it's like also that chemistry of finding the people around you that even if you're a visionary person, to find the people around you to support that vision and to put all those people together. And, you know, we have a joke, like what's the best quality in a band member? And that's like, they show up, you know, so you can have some other guy that's a genius player, but he don't show up or you get everything going and some guy has a kid and a wife and decides, you know, and a girlfriend, he decides he's going to drop out and raise that kid after you just invested 2 years of building up a following. And it's like, so you're at the mercy of all these things, you know? Yeah. And it's not, which makes it hard. And there's a lot of talent that, and at that age, you're so loyal to your friends to where you can't go, you know, loyal to a default, you know, to where you're going to hang out with some guy that's obviously a drunk fuck up for years because he's your brother. You know, but you know that guy in the minute if he got some offer, he would go. And I got to say, I've had some things where people were like, you know, we'll take you, but not the band.
And you
I always chose the band, you know, so if you want to be successful, screw your friends. And I'm just saying,
take the check. Long run,
yeah. In the long run, I'm happy with those decisions, but I definitely had, you know, I've been through enough of that and got to a certain point to where I still try to make sure that, you know, everybody feels a part of it, even if, you know, and included, but I gotta be like, I can't have people hold me back, you know, I'll have to do what I got to do. Cause to me, you're putting your happiness in the hands of another person and you just can't do that. So there's a certain amount of compromise, but at a certain point, it's like a deal killer. You got to move on, you know? And if tomorrow, you know, Ben decided he didn't want to tour and the drummer broke his legs, I guess it would be time for an acoustic record, you know, because I got to get it out. If I don't get it out, they would be horrible friends to keep me from getting it out because it would hurt me. You know, I mean, mentally and emotionally, it would be devastating to me to not be able to create music. So
I'm sure an acoustic record would work pretty damn well as well with your style of songwriting. But before we go there, Mother Love Bone, did you get to catch them back in the day?
Yeah, I opened up probably one of the last shows, Mother Love Bone, maybe 3 weeks before Andy passed. And it was a huge thing. You know, what's funny is the same manager guy that picked me up, he was booking this club in Tacoma called Legends. And they gave me the offer to open for, do I want to open for Nirvana and the Melvins or Mother Love Bone? And I was like, I'll take the Mother Love Bone show, please. And so we, which is funny because, you know, Nirvana, they both went on to be Pearl Jam and Nirvana. But I mean, I must have been, what was that, 1990? When that 91? So, you know, I think I was 17 when I opened that show. You know, everybody else was going to high school and, you know, growing pubic hair or whatever the hell they were doing. I was out there playing with, you know, rock legends at that time. I was ready. You know, I mean, I just knew I wanted to do that since I was a kid. So I was a big fan of them too. And I'd seen them play with Alice in Chains maybe that was probably the second show I saw. I think, I can't remember if it was the first show or the second show. I think the first show was Alice in Chains at like the Renton Musician Hall. And the second show I saw was Alice in Chains and Mother Love Bone at the Kent Skate King. And both of those shows maybe had 100, 200 people tops at those shows. So I was very fortunate, you know, to see those shows.
And even early on, those guys were both gigantic front men, were they? Just larger than life. Forces, on stage.
At the first Alice in Chains was, I would say he was more of a front man there than he was later, because later he kind of, I think a lot of singers kind of play this, you know, they take a role of either they're going to jump around and try to get a crowd going, or they're going to stand in one place and execute the songs, sing them as well as they can, like a Mark Lanegan or Layne Staley or something. Like at first he was very much, you know, had a lot more theatrics and going for it. And then, and I don't think, you know, I think people could say it was drugs or this and that, but I actually think he just made a conscious decision of like, I'm not going to be a clown. I'm going to be a freaking, I'm going to, you know, I want people to be here to hear me for the gift that he had, you know. And of course the check that he was writing as a singer was pretty hard check to cash. Mm-hmm. So if you were running around trying to do jumping jacks on stage, you could probably interfere with your ability to hit that. But Andrew Wood, of course, was super charming and, you know, a different type of singer. It wasn't all about vocal acrobatics, but, you know, he definitely had that thing that maybe like a singer like Ozzy or somebody had, to where you just love them and want them to win, you know?
Yeah.
There's some singers that are like the coolest guys you've ever seen, and you're like, I want to be as cool as that guy. There's other guys that are like Angus Young or something, to where you're just like, why shouldn't that guy win? Why shouldn't we all be clapping for that guy? You know, where they're almost like the underdog or something. And I think Ozzy's a bit that way.
Yeah. You know?
And we did a show with Black Sabbath in Europe one time, and I got to stand on the side of the stage, and you could just see that people just love him. They don't care if he's singing on key or clapping off beat. It's just, they just love Ozzy. And he's not the world's best singer, but he has something that, he has a magical appeal. And I think that Andrew Wood had that same thing, as well as, you know, he was a good singer and a good songwriter as well, but he definitely had that same kind of a aura or a, you know, ability to connect with people in a way that's pretty beautiful.
And then was like the sort of Melvins Nirvana camp, was that almost a different thing stylistically and everything else? Cause they were definitely like a more, coming from more of a punk sort of hard edged sound, right? It seems like that. Less rock and roll, you know, less theatrical.
There was a band in Seattle like called The Accused. Are you familiar with them?
No.
Well, they were pretty big, and Tom Niemeyer from that band went on to play in Grunt Truck. So before, you know, there was that big thing that happened in the late 80s, to where you had like, you know, heavy metal and punk, but there was like this separation when you kind of had all your bands like that were taking over MTV, and they were kind of hijacking hard rock and turning it into boy bands, you know, with your Poison and this and that. And I think that, I think that all those people in Seattle were kind of growing up on something that was 10 years behind the times, because now everything's pretty instant with the internet. And I think that my opinion from living here at that time was, there was this thing to where there was like your metal and your thrash metals that was coming up, you know, and you had bands from here like Sanctuary and Metal Church. And then you had Queensryche, you know, and then there was also your older bands like Heart and stuff, who are kind of more classic rock, you know. But I think all those guys were growing up on Aerosmith and punk. And then, but some of those guys, you know, were a little more metal. And some guys, I think, were like, dude, I'm never going to fit into the pretty boy category. I'm never going to be look as cool as Aerosmith or whatever. So I'm just going to go more the metal route. To where I think that my opinion is, they were listening to like probably full on metal, and they were listening to punk. And a lot of that was, you know, due to bravado. And, you know, and I think the genius of Kurt Cobain was, of course, he also recognized the melodies and stuff of the Beatles and stuff, and was into that, to where there was this like elitist, you were either heavy metal or you were punk, or you were glam or you were metal. And I think that bands like Jane's Addiction from LA came along, and they were like, made it, you could like Susie and the Banshees and The Cure, but you could also like Led Zeppelin and Bad Brains. And they kind of, and then with Lollapalooza and stuff, kind of kicked the door out. And they don't really get the credit for that, because I think, you know, and I think some people have said that, like, you know, Green River saw Jane's Addiction play in LA, and Mark Arm was like, I'm going to be punk. And Jeff and Stone were like, I want to go this route, the more Aerosmith, Led Zeppelin-y route, more like, you know, a classic rock vibe versus a punk rock, you know. Punk, for the whole idea of being freedom, has a pretty confined idea of what you're allowed to do and be punk, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they sure have a uniform that you have to wear to be punk. I love punk rock. I love the Dead Boys and the, you know, all, especially all the earlier bands, the Dead Boys, the Ramones, the, you know, Sex Pistols and all that, but Gun Club, stuff like that, Cramps. But I think that, and then, you know, of course, Mother Love Bone had the big round hats and the big glasses and all that. It was, you know, they were hugely influenced by Jane's Addiction, I think, you know, and I, Jane's Addiction probably should get a lot more credit for what they did to the Seattle scene. And one of their songs actually broke up here on the radio, Jane says, and they played the Paramount. Their first Soul Kiss video was filmed at the Paramount in Seattle. And the bands that opened that show were Soundgarden and Mother Love Bone, you know? Wow. So
yeah, they were the godfathers of alternative rock, weren't they?
Yeah. I mean, and for a minute he was, you know, Perry Farrell was kind of the, you know, the Jesus of, he was the alt-right rock messiah, you know? And then I think that, you know, their band, of course, a lot of those bands, things just happen too fast to people at a young age and they kind of lose touch with who they were or what they were doing that made them magical. Same thing, you know, once Jane's Addiction lost the bass player, something was missing, you know? And we've toured with them and they've made some good music, but those first two records are perfect. You know what,
yeah.
I mean? It's like,
yeah, man.
Perfect. There's not, to me, they're like that. That's the high watermark. You can't make a record better than that, you know?
What sort of a reputation did a band like the Melvins have on the scene back in the day? Because they were one of the first, right? But they didn't really associate for too long with the burgeoning grunge thing, did they?
Well, I mean, I think you can listen to the Melvins and see why. You know, I love the angst of the Melvins and I love the rawness and everything, but it's like, you know, there's definitely something about them that's a little more brutal or a little more, you know, it's definitely the kind of music that inspires people, but is never going to break through to the masses, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that they, I don't know what they think, but if I was their band, you know, I probably would have said, you know, these are the strengths of what our band has. Let's build upon those. But we're never going to, we're a square. If we're going to try to have mainstream success, we're like a square peg trying to fit in a round hole. It's just never going to happen. It's not going to cross over to the other bands where it's, you know, Kurt Cobain with his dreamy blue eyes and a good bone structure and those good melodies has the ability to make that, get over that fence, you know, or bust through that ceiling or whatever, you know.
There was a lot of Hellraisers on the scene back in those days, wasn't there? A lot.
What do you mean?
Like just crazy fucking alcoholic drug addict lunatics. Yeah. They were all creative geniuses, but you know, I mean, like Lanigan's book, some of the stories from, you know, he's so open and honest about the shit he used to get up to, and you read about like Jerry Cantrell, and obviously, you know, Lane, and it seems like there's just a lot of fucking destructive behavior going on.
Yeah, I mean, that's what happens when you, you know, give kids the key to the candy store, you know what I'm saying? I think that you know, we talked a little bit about this before. To me, you know, those people had a spotlight shine on them, but I don't know that their lives were that much different than a lot of people. Like my whole childhood was riddled with, you know, crack addicts and cocaine and heroin users and stuff like that. Was my stepdad and him and all his friends, you know, my cousin spent 17 years in prison due to cocaine and he started getting locked up at like 16 way before I knew about the Seattle bands. I just think the nature, you know, that whole, I think the whole free love thing eventually had a hangover from the 60s. And then through the 70s, it started catching on everywhere. And, you know, the real handle of drugs started to happen. And then, of course, a lot of those people, it's just, I mean, drugs are great. If you want to escape the world, drugs are fucking amazing. But, you know, most people can't hang and eventually it's going to take them down. And I just think that if that's your identity, I think, you know, and it's so shocking, you know what I mean? It's like you got some story about I'm just over it. You know what I mean? The whole story of like, you know, people, it's almost like people think that, you know, if I don't have some kind of heroin drama or something, then I don't, you know, I don't have a real rock and roll story at that, you know, at that point. So I'm not saying that those people have, you know, it is a conflict. So it creates a good story. It's a challenge that, you know, you see this problem that someone's going to have a hard time getting out. And I think people like to see people, they wonder what that's like, or how do they over see, especially if someone overcomes it and gets sober, you know, like I'm a sober guy. My personal opinion is I don't want to bore anybody with a book about how I got fucked up and I got sober. You know what I mean? To me at this point, it's just a shitty, sad tale. And I think that some people, you know, they want their artists to go to hell with gasoline in their pockets, you know, just to kind of, some people think that you have to live through that to be some great artist. Where you got guys like Bruce Springsteen that never even had a drink until his third album.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
What you're saying is the drugs were already there before the music scene kicked off.
Yeah, were there and people were having problems with drugs. And I think, you know, but I do think that there's some, you know, something to a 25-year-old dude that, you know, you just feel impossible. And, you know, that's the beautiful thing about young people is that they'll take some chances that older people weren't. This is why you have soldiers in the army that are 19, because they're going to go be a hero. You give a guy that's 25 a gun, he might go, well, what the hell did they do to me? And then he's going to go find a tree to hide behind. You know, it's the same thing why, you know, if you're a major label or something, you're going to exploit these guys, how sweet it is that they're going to cause a bunch of chaos and confusion. And then people could just cash in on that. It's basically just a marketing tool at some point. You know what I mean? So it's like, if you look back at like, it's so sad at the time I was like, would see it too. But if you look back on, go on YouTube and look up MTV news on all the chaos, you know, Kurt and Courtney are a freaking publicist's dream, you know, and you can watch that Oasis movie when those guys got arrested on the boat, what they call their manager. And what does he say? He says,
brilliant. Brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And it's like,
Alan McGee, good friend of mine, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
And he, you know, it's a publisher's dream. So I think all that stuff, you know,
and he fell foul to that whole thing as well. You know, he fell foul to the rehab and mental breakdown. And I think sometimes, if, particularly if you're just courting it because you think it's dangerous and exciting and, you know, sexy, it's only ever going to end badly.
Yeah. And it is for a minute. You know, even if you can have a couple of drinks, it'll impair, you can, everybody gets pulled over for driving with their lights off because you can actually see better in the dark. And all these great novelists couldn't say what they actually thought until they had a drink. And then once they did, it spilled out of them. And then that becomes a crutch. But as you can see, talking to me, I got no problem spilling out what I think without, I don't need that stuff to help me. But, you know, I mean, I definitely had my challenges and I had some friends that, you know, had a real hard time, and I've lost friends to this same kind of stuff, or they get so bad at the drinking that it's suicide or whatever, or drinking and drugs because they just don't see a way out. And, you know, a lot of people that I really love, a lot of them have recovered from it and grown from the experience. But most of the people that I know that had the hardest issues aren't out bragging about how badass they were. You know, they're usually embarrassed of it and they don't even want people to know, you know? And,
yeah,
you know, to where it's almost like a certain, like a, you get a rock and roll merit badge because you shot heroin, you know what I mean? Which I think is just fucking sad, you know.
Was Andrew the first one to die?
I mean, not in my world, but he was the first rock star, I think, at that time, you know. But, you know, now that you're looking back and now they're finding out that that's probably what killed, you know, Jim Morrison.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, a number of other people have died from the time, but they were dropping like flies during that time because heroin was definitely like you said, it was the sexy thing at the time, you know?
Well, that wasn't necessarily what I was saying. Certainly not. I was more trying to get to the bottom of how much the infiltration of that drug damaged and destroyed that scene.
Yeah, I mean, I think it damaged those people that had the access for it, but it's like, you know, and it damaged some other people. And I definitely have, you know, one of the members of Postpartum Depression's out there still doing that shit, you know, and it damaged our band, you know, and damages people touch. I've definitely played with a few hardcore heroin addicts in my day, and I've definitely lost a few friends to it myself. And it's hugely detrimental and ruined a lot of other people's lives in and out of it, you know. But I don't think it's not just rock stars. Those guys have a pretty easy go of it because they have a budget and people are throwing drugs at them because they want to hang out with them. The guys that have it really bad are the guys that are living in the tent under the freaking viaduct right now and are having to, you know, do God knows what to get a fix just to get through the day, you know. And then same thing with all the fentanyl and prescription drugs and how that, you know, some housewife that never thought, I mean, I knew a friend that was a lady, and then she, you know, started getting on the pills. I mean, and this was 10 years ago or something like that. She started getting on the pills. Pills got too expensive. Next thing you know, she's never dreamed she would be doing heroin. Never imagined it. And all of a sudden, when you can, what costs $200 in pills, you can get for $20 in heroin, you know, and then, you know, eventually it killed her, you know? So it's like, I just don't think there's any glamour in it to me at all. I think it's just fucking horrible. You know,
it's interesting as well, isn't it? We'll move on in a minute as well, but it's interesting that in the 80s, I guess there was the crack epidemic, and I guess white communities and politicians and parents, the parent groups, had very little sympathy for what was happening to the black youth at that time. And now it seems to have switched, doesn't it? And it seems to be a lot of white kids and, you know, middle class, fairly well off white people who are becoming, you know, victims of these things. And now it's almost like they're finally taking notice and going, shit, this is a real problem. You know, and that's kind of a sidestep, but it's just, it was crazy what was going on with the crack epidemic, how little was done at the time. And now it does seem to be a problem because it's like a white problem. It's a real problem.
Well, and that's the problem with all of it is, you know, people are treating it like it's, you know, it's a health issue, you know, not just the individual health, but it's a public health issue. You know what I mean? And I think people just want to, you know, it's like someone made a decision, you know, all of us every day are making good and bad decisions, you know, and some people made some bad decisions and they played with something that got out of control. You know, same thing with alcohol. It's like, I think, you know, alcohol kills a lot of people, but they call it liver disease or a car accident or heart disease. You know, it's not, or cirrhosis of the liver. They don't call it alcoholism. You know what I mean? But really, yep. You know, those people poisoned themselves to a point where they died. And, you know, I've witnessed it happen to people, you know. I've actually had, you know, a few friends have had close calls now. It's like I've lost a friend to it recently that was sober for years and then, you know, started drinking again and then didn't last 6 months, you know. And so I have a few other friends that just you have those learning experiences. Now when I see someone going to, I'm pretty much knocking down their door and blowing up their phone, trying to help them out as much as I can to, like, try to see another way. But it's like, you know, if people are, they just can't think clearly in that situation, you know, they filtered out any alternative life. They just can't imagine their lives. Their brain is not operating at a full, you know, it's like they say, you can't, you know, if someone's signing a contract or they're doing something like that, they can't sign because they weren't in their right mind at the time. Right. Any person that's drinking and driving that started that car up and thought they could get home was not in their right mind at that time. Any point, you know, so, you know, this curiosity, creating a curiosity for those things, you know, and people, you know, dabble in these things and they get deeper and deeper or whatever. And they, or some people, they get hooked on pharmaceuticals by accident and then it ends up killing them. You know, I think it's definitely a health issue that people should be treating as a health issue, not just as like a drug problem. But I don't know the answer. You know, my wife is pretty interested in it. And like, I mean, not just interested, but she takes some action and kind of is, you know, tries to make a difference in some ways. But it seems to me that, you know, there should be a lot more money spent on treatment and, you know, and opportunities for these, and definitely decriminalizing, you know, drug offenses and stuff. You know, throw a guy in jail for stealing a car stereo, but don't throw him in jail for having a drug problem, you know. But you know, I would have to see the statistics. I'd have to have the information and know what the, you know, right thing to do it is. But
did you pull yourself out, or did you have somebody help you?
I had some help, but I definitely pulled myself out. You know, I actually saw going deep, man, but I have some daughters And I just, I read something someday, you know, and I mean, I was definitely a functioning alcoholic, I guess. You know, I still went to work. I did my thing. I still made money. But I also, you know, smoked a lot of pot and did, you know, and I was doing pills and coke and stuff like that. But to me, it all seemed like recreational. And some people, when I got sober, were like, I didn't even recognize that you had a problem, man. But I just, like, I knew that I wasn't reaching my full potential. And then I was starting to get the frickin' how expensive it was, you know? And when I wasn't able to see it, but then when I was doing the math of, like, you know, the, what this cost a month to do it, and just looking at, like, you know, how those resources could be better allocated to me and my family. And then I saw something that said someone said they got sober because they had no desire of their children seeing them that way. So my kids were still young enough to where I was just like, you know, maybe 5 and 6. And I was just like, I don't want to ever have some, I lost my shit because I was drunk and said something that they're going to remember for the rest of their life. You know what I mean? Or They found drugs in my thing and thought, he does it, so well, I guess I'll do it. You know, I just, to me, that was all I needed, was to, like, just think about, you know, I had them. So they were my purpose. And then once I reached out, they definitely had the musician's assistance program. So a manager got me into that. So I went and did a rehab, and, you know, they paid for the whole thing. It was a beautiful thing, and they still do a lot of good work. And if anybody wants a good charity, that's the one I always give to, because I know they're doing the right thing, you know? So helping out a lot of musicians that wouldn't, you know, some people want to do the right thing. They just don't have the resources to do it. That's why they should have more beds and treatment centers and, you know, halfway houses and stuff like that, you know?
And parenthood was a key inspirational driving force, was it? That was, like, one of the main ones you would say that definitely helped you pull it together. And
yeah, that was the only one. I mean, if I didn't have them, I was, you know, I only had myself to answer to, you know, but I, you know, and if I want to beat up on myself, that's okay. But, you know, if what you're doing is going around and it's harming other people, then I kind of look at that a little bit differently. You know, it's like smoking. You know, if you're going to smoke, cool, go outside and go 20 feet away from the building. You don't have to, everybody else don't have to smoke. And that comes down to this COVID shit. You know, people that aren't getting, it ain't about you, buddy. You know what I mean? Your mask or your going out and breathing heavy at the bar could be killing that guy's grandmother. You know what I mean? And It's the same thing with cigarettes. So it's like, sometimes there should be, people shouldn't have resistance or making the rest of the world suffer because of their, for their convenience, you know? And so I didn't want my kids to suffer for me wanting to not accept reality at that point, you know?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
What did you notice from a creative and performance point of view change? And obviously there must have been quite an daunting at first, but then very exciting and rewarding transition that you make from being always under the cloud of something to present and in the moment. And because obviously the common misconception is that that stuff you need to be artistic, but obviously really you are artistic and that just gets in the way, doesn't it? And then once it's gone, yeah. Is it a trip?
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely one of the first things was I went and once I got a rehab and was sober for a month, I went and bought a kick-ass guitar because I was like, I would have spent that much on drugs and alcohol in a month, you know? And then I think I put out, you know, a record's pretty much back to back right after that, you know, because it was just spilling out of me. So
which records were they, Jeff?
The last record that I made that I was high during making it would have been the Missionary Position, Diamonds in a Dead Sky.
Right.
But once I got sober, we followed that up pretty quick with Consequences. And then the first Walking Papers record was done within, you know, I finished two records within 2 years after that, you know. And then I would have been finishing more records, but the complications of starting to be on labels versus making records on your own and stuff like that started to put delays. And then, you know, sometimes the wagon that you're hitched to or, you know, can slow you down or send you in different directions, you know. So it definitely increased my ability to get things done. You know, that's someone, I think Brian Eno said something about like, I've never heard anybody come up with a good idea stoned, right? In the studio.
You think it's good stoned in the moment.
But I think that's bullshit.
Yeah.
I think a lot of good ideas are probably coming up with people that are stoned and a lot of bad ones. But one thing I know for sure, it's a lot easier to put to follow through with those ideas and make them turn into something, you know? And I don't have a problem if someone drinks or smokes weed and that like sends them a spark or puts them in a certain place, you know, that's fine. I don't think it's necessary, but for some people, if that sets their mood and that's what, you know, marijuana does is actually puts these parameters and makes you hyper-focus, but you might hyper-focus on video games or movies, or you might hyper-focus on writing a song. But when that thing starts to become where you're an irritable asshole, if you don't have it, you know, and you have to be the first thing you do in the morning is wake up and smoke weed and throw back a Sparks malt liquor before you can even accept your deal with your angst for the world, you know, then it isn't helping you at any point. You're just, it's just clouding up what you're trying to do, you know. And, you know, the fortunate part, not just the creativity, but you don't have to sit in some sweaty, gross apartment with some people that you would never hang out with otherwise you didn't.
Your social circles change, right?
Right. That's the biggest benefit of it all.
I mentioned this to you the other day, and I really believe that as good as that first Walking Papers record is, the second Walking Papers and then the most recent one for me are much more interesting and layered and superior records. Obviously, when you get all the players in that you have for the first album, I imagine it gets notoriety and attention and press and things like this. But have you found that since you've sort of made the band the band and have developed more just, I guess, as a band leader within that context, have you found your songwriting has improved within that dynamic?
I don't know if it was the
records seem to be getting increasingly better.
Well, I appreciate that. I think that one thing that I liked when I first worked with Barrett is Barrett was very much like, let's get something done. On the first record, we really rehearsed like six times and then he had studio time. So the, you know, the reality of it is that I had some of those songs already written, but it was recorded super fast.
Right.
You know, and with not a lot of thought put into it. So, excuse me for a second.
No worries.
So the big thing, the difference is that, and that's like the thing that what I get if I'm working with Ben Anderson. And when he came in and did some overdubs on that record, but even if you listen to the Missionary Position records, they're really like, there's a lot going on those records, but yeah. We didn't have much budget. So they are kind of low budget. We made them in our home studio in our practice room. I mean, all the two Post-Stardom records and the two Missionary Position records were made in a practice room. Like there was no studio, right? And so,
great arrangements. That goes to show. Great arrangements go a long way.
Yeah, and So then when I worked with Barrett, we went to a real studio, and then you got budget and you're in a hurry and, you know, all these kind of things. And then he's very, just wants to, you know, really just fire things out. He's very like instinctual, but like as a lyricist in a, and for production, you know, like you could put some thought in. So when I work with Ben, Ben's very, holds a magnifying glass up to anything that I do. If I write a song, he expands on it. So what you hear in the second record is the first record, he played keyboards on a couple songs, and so did Duff played bass on a couple songs. But on the second record, you actually hear what happened when we were allowed to like indulge in those things. So even with Barrett, he was very much like, hurry it up. We're going to make a double album. We're going to be, you know, and what we allowed ourselves actually to take the time to actually flesh the songs out.
Right.
And that's what you're hearing. What you're hearing from the first record to the second record is the influence of Ben Anderson and him magnifying the work. You know, it truly is what you know. I mean, we did play live for a while, so we grew as a rhythm section. You can't ask for a better rhythm section than Duff and Barrett. But, you know, a lot of what's making those records sound bigger is like the harmonies and the melodies and working on the layers of things that are going on and keeping interesting things happening. That's all Ben.
And was it just hard trying to keep all your schedules together? Obviously then Guns N' Roses happens again. Was it just a case of like you were waiting around for too long to get those guys together, so you just had to go and find the players to make it happen? Or,
well, we made the record,
yeah, and then toured right for a while.
Well, no, we made the second record in 2015, so the record was done and it sat there
for three years. Was with Barrett and Duff.
Yeah.
Got
you. And so we made the record, but then the Guns N' Roses thing, you know, Duff called and said, you know, he said, guys, I can't support this record. And he didn't even tell us why at first, but I knew why, because he had just went and did the shows with Axl down in South America and stuff. And I was happy for him, but we were kind of in limbo there for a minute. And then I think Barrett kind of looked at it as a step backwards, you know? And I think what he said to me was, any band without all the original members is a joke. And I said, you're the second drummer of Screaming Trees, dude. And I was like, and you and I are the original members. You know what I mean? But, and so then there was kind of actually some confusion about how the songs were coming out. And then I thought maybe, you know, I wrote the majority of the songs. So I was like, man, if we're not going to put that record out, can I just take them and record them on my own? And then they were like, you know, Barrett was like, hell no. You know, he was like, this is one of those things in that band. I gave equal shares to all the songs to everybody in the band, being a team player and just being like, you know, it shouldn't be, you know, even if I wrote the songs, I figure we're all a band, let's just share the money. But when you do that, you also give people control of your songs. So he had control of songs that I wrote. And, you know, since he had time invested in two, he didn't want to see me leaving with the song. So then the record was just stuck there. And then I got an offer to make the Static Land record. And so I had to do it. I had to do something. I didn't know that I would ever make another Walking Papers record. But at that time, I had to write the whole Static Land record in like 6 months. And so I churned it out and kicked it out really quick. But then you finish the record and then it takes 6 months till it's going to come out. And when Duff and Barrett bailed on the thing, the Walking Papers record deal died. So it was the only way I had to get paid to make records. So then I did that. And then I toured on that. And then it had a no compete clause for a year. But by then, all the weirdness of the band kind of settled. And then Barrett asked me to sing some songs for him at some show one day. He was like, I'm going to do a solo show. Will you come sing some Walking Paper songs at it? And I was like, okay, you know.
As if nothing had happened.
Yeah. Well, and I think, I don't know, I get pretty precious and protective of my work, you know. So I was definitely upset about it. And he's got to do what he wants to do. But I didn't think it was very... I don't know. In my opinion, even if I could go back in time, I had to do what I had to do. If I could go back in time, I would have just put the record out and not toured on it. But so, and then I would have just put the Static Land record out and focused on that. But then when I played those shows with him, and then he did a little tour and he asked me if I would just come and sing a bunch of songs for that thing. And I was like, and so then I could see that he was trying to have an olive branch going on there. And I was like, yeah, I'll accept it. And so I did the tour with him too. And then I let him use my van and trailer for his tour. Right. And then he was like, you know, if you want to do the Walking Paper stuff, you know, you feel free. I'm not going to stand in your way. So it's time we put the record out. And so once he did, I was like, cool. And then I was like, well, we got a couple months to wait until my other thing is done. And then when it was done, then we put it out. And then I was like, if you want to tour it. And he's like, no, go ahead. And so I, you know, put together another band to tour it. And that's what we've been doing since. And then, so now I'm free to, you know, Duff and playing with Duff, especially Duff, and playing with Barrett was to opened a bunch of doors for me, and with a lot of connections with like promoters and stuff like that in Europe, especially. And Duff was like, dude, I never knew we were going to all play together forever anyway. So he goes, I just thought you were a great songwriter and I wanted to open the world to what you were doing. So he did exactly that. We're still really good friends, and I'm couldn't be more thankful. Him opening those doors probably did more for bringing my music to people than anything anybody else has done for me. Right. Sincerely, you know, so I have no resentments or regrets at all. That I'm actually have gratitude to both of those guys, but you know, I also got to move on, and now they open that door and more people know Walking Papers than any of my other bands. So that's obviously where I'm going to make, it's still just my songs, whether it was Walking Papers or The Missionary Position or Postartum. I wish it was all under one umbrella.
Yeah.
Wishing is a lot like playing video games, gives you something to do, but it ain't going to get you anywhere. You know,
you look at all three projects really as a continuation of your creative spirit. Then you don't look at them as different lanes of your creative brain.
Yeah. I mean, and if you ask me, the closest thing I ever did to a solo project was the first Walking Papers record. I think Barrett produced it, and he put the energy in some of those songs. I had some of those songs. I had Already Dead when I was in postpartum depression, but I never believed in it. I played him some songs, I said, and he said, that song's great. Let's do that one. Same thing with The Butcher. I had that since for that time. So a lot of the Walking Papers records were actually like songs that I didn't use on other records for one reason or another. And so he saw the beauty in those songs and encouraged me to pursue them. So that's kind of what a good producer does. And I think Barrett is a good producer, you know? And so, and then a couple songs, of course, we did were inspired by us jamming together. And then so the second Walking Papers record is actually closer to what our a collaborative band, you know what I mean?
And what was the name of the engineer that did a bunch of Seattle stuff back in the day who worked on?
Jack Endino.
Yeah, did he work on the most recent record with you?
No.
No,
we worked on with this guy, Aaron Spiro in Tacoma, who's a badass. But I did one of the postpartum records, which Jack Endino actually recorded in our rehearsal room, which was awesome. Because I was like, dude, I want you to make the record, but I don't have money to pay for a studio and you.
He
was like, I'll just come to your room and do it. He actually, there was no ISO booth. He sat in the room. And what his genius is, his thing, he's all about energy. I don't think he even cares what chord you're playing. He's just like, is this feeling good or not? You know? And he definitely has a way of getting that energy in there. He's a really cool guy. I really like him a lot. But I also
he's like an alchemist from the sounds of it.
Yeah. And then when I recorded with him, it's like I definitely got a lot of things from him that I'll use forever. But you know, sometimes too, you know, the thing when you're in a band, you're stuck with these same guys, you got to get new energy in there from different people. You know, I would definitely make a record with Jack anytime in the future, but you know, it just, I also like changing it up because I get new, I have a lot of Jack's tricks from making two albums that I think are, every band should have those tricks. He should write a book on them, but I also get new tricks from other people, you know.
What happened with Velvet Revolver? Am I right in thinking you jam with them?
Yeah, I jam with them, but I kept it secret. So I jam with them in I don't know, I guess that was about 2003. Before, you know, they had Izzy Stradlin and Slash and all those guys in there. And I've seen Duff at some of our shows before. I actually first met Duff at our practice room. So he had seen us play or something and met one of our guys. And he asked, it was really weird. He was like, can I come watch you guys rehearse? And I was like, sure. And, you know, so he showed up at the rehearsal and I think he might've been scoping me out for the Velvet Revolver thing. And then a little while later, then they gave me a bunch of songs. I met him at his house and we listened to, he said, just here's like 15 ideas, pick a handful. So I took a handful home and then I dropped them into Pro Tools and kind of cut them up and spliced them around and made them work around a melody idea that I had. And then they flew me down to LA and then we recorded those songs together, like in a rehearsal room. But I just don't think I was their guy, because I think Slash wanted someone that's, you know, more like Miles Kennedy with the kind of high end, like getting some of those Iron Maiden kind of notes and stuff like that. And that just ain't, I'm just not that kind of singer, you know? And of course they had that other Scott Weiland came around. He's not the kind of singer either, but he sold 40 million records. Yeah. So I think Slash was willing to compromise his lose not having a singer with the high notes as long as they sold, you know, because I think everyone saw the super group idea. And so I think the thing that I played well on that is I was like, they were filming for some show. I think you can watch it. Like,
yeah, there's a documentary on YouTube, I think, and they're trying to find.
Yeah, I was having none of that. You know, I was like, I'll come sing your thing, and no one's filming me doing it because I'm not going to have my biggest claim to fame being I'm the guy that didn't get the gig to sing for Velvet Revolver. So yeah. That was kind of my stipulation. I was like, I'll do it, but I'm not doing your TV show. And
let me ask you this: Did you take an audio recording of the practice?
Have you got that? I have a recording, but then what I did, I didn't share it with anybody. They had a thing in Rolling Stone where a bunch of people were like showing
leaking tapes or whatever.
Yeah, and then they had a whole article, and I found that some of those guys never even met them. Like right. They got a tape to try out to, but they never. So those guys were exploiting it to try to get, and that just ain't my thing, you know. So. I think because of that, you know, Duff recognized I was worth having a relationship with because he knew he could trust me to not spill the beans. And so I never told anybody about it except for like my friends, never in any press or anything. And I made three records after that where I could have used that to at any time. Right. But then we were doing an interview and he brought it up. And so when he brought it up, I was like, well, I guess it's free game. I can talk about this now at this point. Right. So, but I was just always like, I would have never told anybody out of respect for those guys and their privacy and whatnot, you know.
Cool experience though, right? Was it?
Yeah. I mean, it was great. I mean, I love those records. And then you're standing there with Slash and Izzy Stradlin and they're all, you know, those are the guys when I was, you know, 13 years old or 14 years old, that was the thing for me, you know, because I was, like I said, with those heavy metal Headbangers Ball bands and stuff, I was like, I ain't pretty enough to be in those bands. And I was like, no one wants to see me in spandex. I was born without an ass or calf muscles, you know? And so when Guns N' Roses came out, that's what me and all my friends looked like. We were a bunch of kids with faded jeans with holes in our knee in our knees, and we all had greasy stupid leather jackets, and they looked like we did, you know what I mean? They felt that was like the band for us, you know. And like I said, like we were caught between that. I was like, I'm not a spiked wristband heavy metal guy, headbanger guy, and I'm not a super glam rocker dude. And so they kind of were that band for all the people that thought those other two extremes were a little kind of too ridiculous or something. They were kind of the band that for everyone else that didn't sit in either of those, you know. I wasn't into Merciful Fate and I also wasn't into Wiener. Yeah. You know what I mean? I needed something in the middle, you know. So thank God for Guns N' Roses.
Were you a big Ramones fan growing up?
Yeah, I mean, I love the Ramones.
So and I was touring with Dee Dee when you got to do that.
Oh, it was great. And this is, I'm going to tell you the Dee Dee Ramone calling me on the telephone because we had a, I think we played the Big Dipper in Spokane was one of the shows. We did a little West Coast tour with him. And when we played the Big Dipper, we were in this really horrible hotel room and Dee Dee was like, of course we were like four guys that, you know, just partying and getting crazy and we're overjoyed that we were on tour with Dee Dee Ramone and he called us up on the phone. He's like, hey guys, can you keep it down over there? We got a long drive tomorrow. That's been we've been repeating that story for years. We really love that one. And then when I met him, he was like, hey Jeff, he's like, I think your songs are just perfect. Don't let no producers put their chords in your song. They just want part of your royalties, man. Don't let them do it. Your songs Amazing. Are just fine. And if you got Didi Ramone telling you your songs are just fine, you're good.
Well, he knew a thing or two about writing a good tune, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. He's a genius. And we did play Idaho with him, too. And I always think about that song Danny Says, where he's like, you know, I record stores and
got to go to Idaho. Right, 20 below. Yeah.
Yeah. That, and that's just, and I'm like, here I am playing Idaho with Didi Ramone. You know?
I live for little details like that. I love it.
Well, I got to tell you, to me, like, and we were talking about earlier with, like, you know, if something didn't happen to me or if I wish that it was different, I actually am pretty grateful for all those experiences that I've gotten to have without having become a casualty to the rock stardom, you know? So those things to me
still
are
still here.
Yeah. They're gold, you know, and I have a lot of rich memories with those kind of experiences and stuff. That's like stuff that, you know, basically, you know, I never wanted to be a rich, famous guy. I wanted to be in a rock band. I wanted to make records and I wanted to see the world and I wanted to play fucking rock and roll and make great records. At this point, I probably made, in my opinion, more records and better records than some of the bands that inspired me in the first place. And at this, and I've got to have all those same experiences. Now I just wish that when I went back, I would have just added rich to my dream. You know, I want to be a rock star. I should have added, I want to be a rich rock star. Dream big. If you're going to dream, dream big, you know. But all my dreams came true as far as that part went. I have no regrets about that. And I feel pretty fortunate to have seen, believed that stuff of people said, if you work hard enough, it'll happen. You know?
Yeah, you must have seen so many bands. Like you were telling me the other day, just as we approached the end as well, you were telling me about around that same time you did the DD tour. I guess this would have been like the first post-stardom record. You were touring early on with Queens of the Stone Age as well, like before they popped. And what was the exchange you had with Josh where he said something to you?
Well, we toured with them and they had, you know, same thing back then. We had a lot of like people like Steve Jones and stuff like that that would call us up. And we had like Jim Dickinson, who played with, you know, Bob Dylan on Time Out of Mind. He wanted to produce our record. And so we had, you know, got in, a lot of those bands came aware of our band. So there's this band Loudermilk, and I wrote a couple songs with them, and they were making a record at Sound City. And on the other side, Queens were making the Rated R record.
Yeah.
And so in the lobby, they were asking those bands, like the other band, like, you know, what are you into or whatever, and they're trading things. And he had played Josh the first post-stardom record or demos for that record. And so it was before we even made a record. So he invited us out to do some dates with them before we even made a record.
On the strength of the demo.
Yeah. And so we were stoked. It was like probably the first tour that we did with a national band. You know, it's just like a handful of shows. But then, you know, one time he was actually really cool. We were like, I think we were in Victoria, Canada was the first show. And it was really cold. And we were actually in a minivan with a shitty trailer behind it. And we were like, at the end of the show, we played the show. They were great. They were really nice. And they were really receptive when we did sound check and everything. And after the show, we were just sitting in the parking lot and like cuddling up into the van to go to sleep.
Freezing your ass off.
Yeah. And he was like, what are you guys doing? And we're like, we're going to just sleep right here, man, going to bed. And he's like, he actually made the promoter get us hotel rooms and order us a pizza. And then for the rest of the shows, they made sure that every promoter got us a hotel room and food, which was really cool. But then he did take me on the bus, and I was telling him, I was like, you know, he took me on the bus, but, you know, and I was saying they were so powerful, you know, they were so powerful. They had to turn their amps away from the audience because it was so loud. It was really an experience. And they were using these huge Sun bass cabinets and stuff like that. And, you know, like two of them in like a club for 200 people, you know, and he's just, and it was just melt your face off. And I was telling him, I was like, you guys are like the most powerful band I've ever seen. And he was like, yeah, but you write great songs. And I was like, you know, you get these little nuggets from people that you look up to, and it's enough to keep you thinking you're onto something. You know, that encouragement, it validates what you're doing, you know?
Yeah, man. And as you say, it's not just people who are like well-known, but people who are, you know, the heads of their field. You know, mm-hmm. if they're going to compliment you on your craftsmanship, knowing that their craftsmanship is of the level that it is, that's enough right there to know you're onto a good thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, you hope so. I mean, well, at least it means that you feel accepted or validated for the thing, because commercial success, like we talked about earlier with all the different band people that you're playing with and this and that, it can go, uh-oh. Which I got to tell someone, suck it.
So good, dude.
That's
that famous Seattleites house you're renovating at the moment. Just hang it.
That was actually the bass player for Postpartum Depression.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was. But I've already talked to him 3 times today. So seriously, I have like some little things going on. But he's one of my favorite people on the planet, you know. But he's one of those guys too that he had some kids and he was just like, I'm done, you know. He's like, and he was in some bands before he played with us, and he was just kind of, that's why the missionary position had a key bass.
Right.
Because I was like, I'll never have a cooler bass player than that guy. He was so
not going to even try.
Yeah. Love so it. I was like, we know we're going to lose this game, so we just won't play, you know? And that's how cool he was. And then of course, and didn't play with the bass player until Duff came along, which I figured is one of the best bass players on the planet. But who's cooler? I don't know. He's pretty fucking cool. Yeah, he definitely had the Dee Dee Ramone thing going on. He learned a lot from Dee Dee, I suppose.
Well, what are you going to say before the phone rang?
I don't remember.
It's gone. Well, whatever it was.
Oh, it was validation or something from the, you know, you get that acceptance from your peers or whatever. And I think at the end of the day, that's probably feels as good as a sports car or a swimming pool. You know, it's not tangible, but it's, you know, it goes with you, you know.
Well, dude, it seems like life's good, and it seems like despite everything going on in the world at large, you seem happy and in a good place, and it's been really lovely talking to you, man.
Yeah, it was a total pleasure. Thanks for knowing who we are. Sometimes you do an interview, and they're like, they never even heard you, you know, that you're knowing they haven't even heard the record, you know, so it's great.
Well, it's always my thing to do my homework, and luckily, because I get to pick the guests because it's just my show, I always pick people that I know I'm going to enjoy the work of, you know, and I've spent the last couple of weeks just digging, not just the Walking Papers stuff, but all the albums and just loads of great material, man. It'll be, you know, something that I revisit time and time again for a long time. And I hope I got to see you play at Hellfest in France a few years back, but I hope to see you guys in a nice club show environment in the UK when that kind of thing's allowed again. And, keep doing it, dude. Take care.
See ya.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.